This episode of History of the Christian Church here on the Enduring Word YouTube channel begins a series on the Crusades. In the very first of our episodes, we took a look at the various ways that history has been studied over time. In the ancient world, history was more often than not propaganda. The old adage that history is written by the winners was certainly true for the ancients. With the implementation of the scientific method in the modern era, researching and recording of history became more unbiased and accurate. Now, note that I said more, because no report of history can be entirely accurate. Historians include the implicit bias of deciding what to report and what to leave out. Still, with the modern recording of history, historians recognize that their task was to be unfiltered by bias. The history that they told could no longer be considered just blatant propaganda. The postmodern era has seen a return to bias, this time an almost knee-jerk suspicion of previous attempts to recount history. Even attempts of modernity to document history are suspect and assumed guilty of recording little more than the biases of the authors, though their works were footnoted and peer-reviewed. Postmodern critics adopt a presupposition that all recorded history is fabrication, especially if there's anything, well, heroic or virtuous. If it's a dark tale of hopelessness and tragedy, well, then maybe it can be accepted. It's almost as though postmoderns want to, well, make up for the ancient historians' penchant for propaganda. Postmoderns cast history as, may I say, negpaganda, coining a new word. What used to be propaganda, that is the promotion of a certain person, group, or idea, the postmodern historical motif turns into negpaganda, a denigration of those things. But that's not the end of the postmodern program. It rewrites and redacts history by layering back over the past postmodern values and ideas. As we dive into this next era of church history, let's attempt a shedding of our bias, even though we can't fully do that, as we look at the Crusades. Instead of layering onto the Christians of Europe in the 11th and 12th centuries the sensibilities of people who live almost 1,000 years later, let's attempt to understand the reasoning behind the idea of taking up a pitchfork or a sword and making a life-altering trip over hundreds of miles through strange lands to risk one's life for what? Oh yeah, to rid the Holy Land of pagan infidels. Wait, Mr. Crusader person, have you ever been to the Holy Land? Do you own land there that's been stolen by the Muslims? Do you have relatives or friends that you need to protect there? Have you ever met one of those infidels? Do you know what they believe or why they invaded? No? Well, then why are you so amped about marching halfway around the world to liberate a land you've not been all that interested in before from a people you know nothing about? Do you see the point? There must have been powerful forces at work in the minds and hearts of the people of Europe that they would go in such large numbers on a crusade. Now, we may find their reasons for crusading to be horribly ill-conceived, but they were totally sold out to them. The Crusades reflected a new dynamism in the Christianity of medieval Europe. People were driven by religious fervor, a yearning for adventure, and of course, if some personal wealth could be thrown in, all the better. For 200 years, Crusaders tried to expel the Muslims from the Holy Land. It seems all the colorful figures of this era were caught up in the cause, from Peter the Hermit in the First Crusade to the godly Louis IX, King of France, who inspired the Sixth and Seventh Crusades. Many Europeans of the medieval period viewed a pilgrimage as a form of especially poignant penance. These pilgrimages were usually adventures to a more local holy place or shrine that had been erected to commemorate a miracle, or to cathedrals where the relics of some saint were kept in a special container called a reliquary. But there was one pilgrimage that was thought to gain a special dose of grace, a trip to the holy city of Jerusalem. The merchants of Jerusalem did good business in keeping the constant flood of Christian pilgrims supplied with food, lodging, and of course, sacred mementos. Some pilgrims went by themselves, others in a group, ancient versions of the modern-day Holy Land tour. When pilgrims arrived in Jerusalem, they would make the rounds of all the traditional points of interest. They walked the Via Dolorosa to Calvary and sat for hours praying. When these pilgrims returned home, they were esteemed by their community as real saints, towering figures of spirituality. For centuries, peaceful pilgrims traveled from Europe to Palestine. The arrival of Islam in the Middle East in the 7th century didn't really interfere. By the 10th century, European bishops were organizing mass pilgrimages to the Holy Land. In fact, the largest that we know of set out from Germany in 1065 with some 7,000. That's a lot of buses. To impede a pilgrim's journey was considered by the medieval church as a serious breach of protocol because you endangered the pilgrim's salvation. If his pilgrimage was penance for some sin, you might deny him pardon by your altering of his course. The mindset of European Christians became one of extreme care to not interfere with pilgrims once they set out. All of this faced a major problem in the 11th century when a new Muslim force took control of the Middle East. The Seljuk Turks, recent and fanatical converts to Islam, came sweeping in to plunder the entire region. They seized Jerusalem from their fellow Muslims and then moved north into Asia Minor. The Byzantine Empire tried desperately to stop their advance, but at the Battle of Manzikert in 1071, the Turks captured the Eastern Emperor and scattered his army. Within just a few years, nearly all of Asia Minor, chief source of Byzantine wealth and troops, was lost. And the new Byzantine Emperor sent frantic appeals to the West for their help. He pleaded with Europe's nobility and the Pope, seeking mercenaries to aid in the rescue of their lost territory. Then, reports began to trickle back about the abuse of Christian pilgrims on the Turkish-controlled roads to Jerusalem. That trickle turned into a stream and then to a river. Even when pilgrims weren't mistreated, they were subject to heavy fees for traveling through Muslim lands. A brief description of the inception, the origin of the First Crusade goes like this. In 1095, the Eastern Emperor Alexius I sent an urgent appeal for help against the Muslims to Pope Urban II. The Pope responded by preaching one of history's most influential sermons. In a field near Clermont, France, he said to the huge crowd that had gathered, quote, "Your Eastern brothers have asked for your help. Turks and Arabs have conquered their territories. I, or rather the Lord, begs you, destroy that vile race from their lands," unquote. But there was more to Urban's appeal than just liberating the East from the infidel hordes. He also mentioned the European need for more land. He said, quote, "For this land which you inhabit is too narrow for your large population, nor does it abound in wealth, and it furnishes scarcely food enough for its cultivators. Hence it is that you murder and devour one another. Enter upon the road to the Holy Sepulchre. Wrest that land from the wicked race and subject it to yourselves," unquote. Now, Urban's mention of them murdering one another was accurate. This was the time of feudalism and mounted knights. Warfare was part of the medieval way of life. Eldest sons inherited the family name and estate, leaving their younger brothers with little to do but mount up and, well, ride off on some quest to see someone else's lands. Warfare was so common and so deadly that the church even weighed in by trying to set rules for combat. The development of chivalry was an attempt to moderate the warlike impulses of European nobility. Despite the church's attempts to moderate the violence, Europe's nobles continued slugging it out. Pope Urban thought it a grand idea to turn their swords away from one another to a common foe, that wicked one that had all but closed the pilgrimage routes to the Holy Land. The popes and bishops were accustomed to making such bold proclamations and issuing stirring appeals. They were nearly always met by a loud amen and affirmations of the rightness of their call. Then people went home to lunch and promptly forgot all about what they just heard. So the response to Urban's sermon at Clermont that day was astonishing. The crowd began to chant, "Deus vult, God wills it." But they did more than chant. People across the entire socioeconomic spectrum of Europe began preparations to do precisely what the Pope had said. Go to Jerusalem and liberate it from the Muslims. They sewed crosses onto their tunics, painted them on their shields, fired up the smithies, and made swords, spears, and maces. Commoners, who couldn't afford armor or real weapons, made clubs and sharpened sticks. They were going to go on a new kind of pilgrimage, not as humble worshipers, but as armed warriors. Their enemy wasn't the world, the flesh, and the devil. Yeah, it was the Muslim infidel defiling the holy places. As the Pope ended his impassioned appeal to the loud affirmations of the crowd, he declared their slogan, Deus Vult, would be the Crusader battle cry in the coming campaign. The pilgrims agreed to, well, make their way east any way that they could, gathering at Constantinople. Then they'd form into armies and march south towards the enemy. The First Crusade was underway. As word spread across France and Germany of the Holy Mission, people from across all social levels were caught up in Crusader fervor. Similar excitement was seen in the California and Yukon gold rushes. It's not difficult to understand why. Now, we need to be careful here because, removed by 1,000 years, we can't presume to know the motivations that shaped every Crusader's actions, though not a few people claim to be able to do just that. Surely, motives were mixed and diverse. Some, out of simple obedience to the Church and the Pope, believed that it was God's will to expel the Muslims from the Holy Land. Being illiterate peasants, they couldn't read the Bible or know God's will on the matter. They believed that it was the Pope's duty to tell them what God willed and trusted him to do it. When the Pope declared anyone who died in the holy cause would bypass purgatory and enter directly into heaven, all the incentive needed to go was provided for thousands who lived in the constant fear of ever being good enough to merit heaven. Another powerful incentive was the opportunity for wealth. Medieval Europe was locked in a rigid feudalism that kept the poor in perpetual poverty. There was simply no rising above the social level that one was born into. But a crusade, that offered a chance at the unthinkable. The loot of a successful campaign could bring incredible wealth, even to peasants. And those who returned gained a reputation as a warrior that could see them and their sons raised into positions of relative honor in some noble's army. The risks were great, but the benefits were both tangible and significant. So thousands took up the Crusader cause. The problem for the multitude of peasants who wanted to go was there was no noble who would lead them. On the contrary, the nobles wanted their serfs to stay home and tend their flocks and fields. But the Pope's appeal had gone out to all, and no noble wanted to be seen as contradicting the Church. So they just hoped that no one would rise to lead the peasants. It was one of those moments of a leadership vacuum that just begged to be filled. And the one who filled it was a man known as Peter the Hermit. Of all the Crusaders, Peter surely had the strongest odor. The monk had not bathed in decades. He rode a donkey that eyewitnesses said bore a remarkable resemblance to its owner. Peter's preaching was even more powerful than his scent. In 9 months, he gathered 20,000 peasants under his banner and then began the long and difficult trek to Constantinople. They created chaos as soon as they arrived. Complaints of robbery poured into the emperor's office. He knew these Western European peasants were no match for the Muslims, but he couldn't let them camp out in his city. So they were ferried across the channel, where they immediately began pillaging the homes of Eastern Christians. Many of these poor, uneducated, and illiterate peasants had come for the loot and saw plenty of it, well, right there. They'd already traveled a long way from home and were now among a people who, well, spoke a different language, wore different clothes, ate different foods. The attitude of the Europeans seemed to be, hey, these people don't look like Christians at all. What's that? They don't follow the Pope? Well, they must not be Christians. Didn't we set out to fight unbelievers? Well, here's some. Let's get to work. Now, someone said, but these aren't Muslims. The reply probably was something like, okay, we'll compromise. We won't kill them. We'll just take their stuff. You know, Peter's peasant army put additional strain on the already poor relations between Eastern and Roman churches. 2 months later, the peasants marched straight into a Muslim ambush and were wiped out. Peter, their leader, was in Constantinople rounding up supplies. He was the lone survivor. He then joined another army, this one led by the European nobility who arrived sometime after the peasants. These crusaders, armed with the latest in military gear, defeated the Muslims at Antioch and then continued on to Jerusalem. The Muslims failed to take the second movement of the Crusades seriously. It's not difficult to understand why. They just easily defeated a huge force of Europeans, and they assumed that they'd do the same to the smaller force that came against them now. What they didn't realize was that this force, while indeed smaller, was the cream of Europe's warrior class, mounted and armored knights who had cut their teeth on battle. On July 15th of 1099, Jerusalem fell. It was a brutal massacre. Around the Temple Mount, blood flowed ankle deep. Newborn infants were thrown against walls. It wasn't just Muslims that knew the Crusaders' wrath. A synagogue was torched, killing the Jews trapped inside. Some of the native Christians were also put to the sword. And to this day, the wholesale slaughter of the First Crusade affects how Jews and Muslims perceive the Christian faith. But, and this in no wise justifies the barbarity and brutality of the Crusades, it seems just a tad hypocritical for Muslims to decry the atrocities of these Crusaders when it was by the very same means that they'd laid claim to the Holy Land in the 7th century. In truth, while crusading under the Christian cross is a horrible violation of the morality of biblical Christianity, jihad, holy war, is one of the main tenets of Islam. Long before the Pope erroneously offered absolution to crusaders and the promise of heaven to those who died in the campaign, Islam promised paradise to Muslims who died in jihad. Historically, while the Christian faith has spread by the work of humanitarian missions, Islam has spread by the sword. Or we might say, while true Christianity expands by the sword of the Spirit, Islam's sword is made of steel. Following the conquest of Jerusalem, the Crusaders carved out four states in the Middle East: the Kingdom of Jerusalem, the County of Tripoli, the Principality of Antioch, and the County of Edessa. This first crusade was followed by eight more, none of them able to accomplish the success of the first, if we could call it success. All told, the gains of the Crusades lasted just 200 years. But one major accomplishment was the reopening of international trade between Europe and the Far East, something that had languished for, well, a few hundred years. The Crusades have proven to be the focus of much historical study and debate. They're usually linked to the political and social situation in 11th century Europe, the rise of a reform movement within the papacy, and the political and religious confrontation of Christianity and Islam in the Middle East. The Umayyad Caliphate had conquered Syria, Egypt, and North Africa from the predominantly Christian Byzantine Empire, and Spain from the Arian Christian Visigoths. When the Umayyads collapsed in North Africa, several smaller Muslim kingdoms emerged and attacked Italy in the 9th century. Pisa, Genoa, Catalonia battled various Muslim kingdoms for control of the Mediterranean. The Crusaders were emboldened in their prospects for success in the Holy Land because of the successes that they had had in the Reconquista, that's the conquest of the Muslim Moors in the Iberian Peninsula, modern Spain. Earlier in the 11th century, French knights joined the Spanish in their campaign to retake their homeland. Shortly before the First Crusade, Pope Urban II encouraged the Spanish Christians to reconquer Tarragona, using much of the same symbolism and rhetoric that he later used to preach the crusade to the people of Europe. Western Europe stabilized after the Saxons, Vikings, and Hungarians were brought into the church by the end of the 10th century. But the demise of the Carolingian Empire gave rise to an entire class of warriors who had little to do but fight among themselves. As I said, the incessant warfare sapped Europe of its strength and wealth. Europe needed an external enemy that they could turn their wrath on. As we saw in a previous episode, while the violence of the knights was regularly condemned by the church, and there were attempts to regulate them in treaties that were known as the Peace of God and the Truce of God, the knights largely ignored these attempts at pacification. The church needed an external threat that they could direct the knights' lust for battle towards. It was also at this time that the popes were in a constant competition with European rulers over the issue of investiture. That's the question of who has the authority to appoint bishops. And some of the squabbles between church and these rulers, the popes weren't above calling out knights and nobles loyal to them to back down the power of a king or emperor or some other recalcitrant noble. And so the popes mobilizing an armed force wasn't all that far out of context. Another reason that Pope Urban called for the First Crusade may have been his desire to assert control over the East. Remember that the Great Schism had occurred just 40 years before, and the churches had been rent ever since. While historians suggest this as one of the several reasons driving Pope Urban's decision to start the Crusade, there's no real evidence from any of his letters that this factored into his plans. Until the Crusaders' arrival, the Byzantines had continually fought the Muslim Turks for control of Asia Minor and Syria. The Seljuks, who were Sunni Muslims, had at one time ruled the Great Seljuk Empire, but by the First Crusade they divided into several smaller states at odds with each other. If the First Crusade had been waged just a decade before, it probably would have been crushed by a united Seljuk force. But by the time they arrived in the Middle East, the Seljuks were at odds with each other. Egypt and most of Palestine was controlled by the Arab Shiite Fatimid Caliphate, which was far smaller since the arrival of the Seljuks. War between the Fatimids and the Seljuks caused great disruption for the local Christians and Western pilgrims. The Fatimids lost Jerusalem to the Seljuks in 1073 and then recaptured it in 1098, just before the arrival of the Crusaders. More than anything else, it was this disunity among the Muslims of the Middle East that allowed the Crusaders to capture their great prize, Jerusalem. They arrived in Palestine, as it was called at that time, at the perfect moment to seize the Holy City.